right, that's the best plan to do. So
House Committee on Revenue for May 11, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2662. Dave, do you want to tell us about the bill, and then we'll hear from Representative Buckley.
Yes, sir. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, this bill, House Bill 2662, comes from Policy Committee, Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. Establishes the Paid Forward Program. By the way, for your background information, from the Policy Committee's step measure summary describes the program. This bill also directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, HEC, to establish the parameters of the program by rule. And for the Office of Student Access and Completion to administer the program.
Very good. Representatives.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. Thank you for your time and consideration of the Pay It Forward bill. I'm supportive of this bill for a very simple reason. We're failing an entire generation, Mr. Chair and members. I have kids in that generation. Many of you have kids or grandkids in that generation. We are graduating students with debt loads they cannot function with. They cannot buy homes. They cannot invest. We are limiting a generation in a way that I think is just simply unacceptable. There's an organization in my district. It's an environmental organization, but they call themselves the Hair on Fire organization. And you probably might have heard of them in terms of the environmental bills before us. And their attitude is, the reason they call them the Hair on Fire organization is because they see climate change happening. They see things happening in a way that is so threatening to the next generations that they feel they must take action. And so they're saying, we're the Hair on Fire people. I join with them. My hair is on fire for the generation that is trying to make their way through higher education. And as you know, I've tried to find the way to do budgets in the past 6 years that we've come out of the recession to try to help rebuild the education system. And as Senator Devlin and I said in the framework that we released in January, this is about as good as it gets, Mr. Chair. This right now, given the way that the economy is recovering, given are the needs of the state projected forward, given the revenue projected for the state going forward, it's not going to get a heck of a lot better unless we do something structurally different, structurally significant. Pay it forward is a gamble. Pay it forward is something new. Pay it forward is a different idea. Pay it forward is idealistic in the attitude it presents that says we are going to make a commitment. As a generation, our generation will make a commitment that if we can access higher education, that we will pay a percentage of our income for that access for the next 20 years. We will pay that percentage in order that the generation behind us will be able to access to higher education. It's idealistic, it's out of the box, it's unusual, but the status quo, the standard operating procedure that we have now has to change. It's not working. We are failing a generation. We are putting ourselves at risk of failing a second generation after them. There is a generation that I'm speaking for right now. I'm definitely not part of it, but they've come to me and they've asked me to support this bill. They've come to me and actually give voice to their generation, what their generation wants to do. It is unusual. It is idealistic. It's a totally different way of doing things. It's basically saying if the state will help us set up this program and we can scale it to whatever size makes sense, get it started, get a handful of students through it that shows that they can access higher education, they can have their tuition costs covered, they can graduate without massive debt in exchange for committing a percent of their future earnings to pay not only for their education, but also pay for the education of the generation behind them coming up. And that way, each generation helps the next generation come along. You'll hear testimony that doesn't pencil out. That there are some people in some majors, an engineering major, well, over time, that person's going to pay more than if they'd just taken out a 20-year loan. Well, there's nothing in this program that says you have to be part of it. This program says this is something you would choose to do, and the state would allow a certain number of students to choose to do this as we go forward. So I know it's a difficult concept. I know it's a new concept. I know it's a big concept. But my hair is on fire, Mr. Chair, and I feel an absolute need to do anything I can to try to change the direction that we've placed our next generations in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to come and testify with my fine fellow member from Southern Oregon. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Park Rose, and Maywood Park. I want to just speak briefly to you about two kind of critical points about the pay it forward concept. First, when I try to explain this to people briefly, and I know many of you have heard different testimony about this in different committees and on the floor in the past, but the simplest way to think about pay it forward, to use a word I hate, as a paradigm shift, is I think of it like reverse Social Security. In Social Security, right now, you pay, all of us, kind of on faith, pay a little bit at a time every year over a number of years, and then we get that benefit at the end. This reverses that. This gives a benefit, an educational benefit, a long-range payoff benefit up front, and then you pay it back over the next 20 years. So if you kind of think about it that way, it simplifies what we are trying to do with pay it forward. It is changing. It is giving an opportunity to come up with a totally new outside the box way of making higher education, which we all agree is critical, not only now but more so into the future for our students to be able to attain success, continue to be contributing members of our society. I just want to talk briefly about two things. First of all, I want to talk about how the need to take on debt is affecting certain students. It's very interesting to me, the more I read about this, is aversion to debt really does limit people's educational choices. And it particularly limits some of those students that we are most trying to get to support into higher education. Hispanic and Asian students are less likely to borrow. Children from immigrant families are much likely to borrow. And just students from families with limited experience in borrowing are less likely to borrow. And when you are averse to that, the other ways that students would take to try to make it more affordable in the long term are often likely to decrease their chances of success. They take a smaller course load, they live at home, they work at the same time. All of those things often conspire against them in the long run in their ability to succeed and achieve either a certificate, a two-year degree, or a four-year degree. So I think the pay it forward idea as a way to really get at those students who we are very interested in keeping involved in this system and helping to overcome that debt aversion that they have historically and in their families. And then I also want to talk specifically about why it is a good idea for us to pass this bill now. House Bill 2662, this was the result of a long and thoughtful work group process at the HEC itself. It started, as many of you know, as a capstone project in a Portland State University class taught by my good friend Barbara, and I'm going to say Galvin, which is not her last name, Barbara Dudley. Thank you. I have a lot of Barbaras in my life. We tend to gravitate toward each other. So not only did you have that initial burst of work by that capstone group, then it came to this legislature where we passed on to the HEC the idea of, hey, work on this. See what you can come up with. HEC worked on it. They said, hey, this is a great idea. Let's keep moving it forward. So this really is an idea that has been very thoroughly worked through and vetted. And this is not passing 2662, passing pay it forward, is not an all in. You're committing, you know, yourself, the legislature, and future legislatures to huge, ungovernable expenditures. The bill itself does not spend any money. It merely creates the framework in which the HEC and OSAC can construct the pilot program. It provides flexibility as to how we decide to finance, whether we finance the pilot this session or the opportunity to develop a public-private financing system in the future, in the interim. And the state's liability really is limited, even in a worst-case scenario. So say we do a small pilot, we invest in this, and I would say even in that, we would get a lot of good information pretty quickly. And in the first couple years, we'd find out about what kind of majors people were in that were choosing this. In 4 years, we can start to get completion data. In 6 years, we can get salary data about how what the long-term payoff is for this. But even if, you know, goodness forbid, we should have a 100% default rate, worst case, we have provided X number of students with the ability to gain a higher education. And I think that we have probably invested in this legislature in worse things that we didn't get any of our money back in the long term as well. So yet at the same time, this is the premise is to set this up as an ongoing money coming back into the system with people paying it forward in the future. And I've been thinking about this a lot because last week in this committee, we had, I cannot remember the exact name, but the grant for Oregon through the universities, where it's investment in these places where they do university research, and then over time it is the one place, because somebody mentioned this, that we actually sometimes get some of that money back. And I thought, well, here we are with another example, and everyone commented on, oh my goodness, most of the tax credits or whatever it is that we, other things like that we do, we rarely get any money back in. But this is set up so that it will be a revolving cycle, and as I said, worst case, we've invested in a chunk of students in getting them a long-term higher education. So I wanted to thank you for hearing this. We have many advocates that I think are going to speak to it with more specific details. And I thank you, and we're happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this concept. It's extremely interesting. Is the is the amount that people pay looking into the future deductible off their tax return?
As in, like a tax deduction?
Yes.
Date? I would guess no, but I would defer to LRO staff or
your cousin.
I haven't studied that part yet, so I don't have answer to that.
We will, Mr. Chair and residents, we'll get that answer for you.
Follow up.
Please, yeah.
So the way when I was studying on the weekend, I thought, well, one side or the other is going to bear the cost of that, either student, because they're going to have to pay taxes on the money first and then pay the after-tax 3%, which increases their cost by whatever their tax situation may be, or the state, if it's the other way around. But I couldn't find in any of my readings anybody addressing the issue.
Interesting. I would say they would have to pay taxes, even if they were paying back a traditional loan, they would still be paying tax on their income first and then
except for interest,
paying that back.
Interest deductible. No, it isn't.
Yeah. Right. And in this, I believe it's not structured. It's structured as an interest-free, I believe. So I guess you wouldn't be able to deduct that.
Well, in the state, obviously, the issue would be what is it really, instead of 3%, is it closer to 4.5%, or what is that real number for the students anticipating utilizing this program?
Great point. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions?
Yeah, Representative Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you guys being here. And, of course, it's the second time we've heard this session. We heard it in higher ed, and we had a very nice, full, comprehensive hearing there. And the point I made then is that, you know, this has been kind of a shiny object that's been kicked around for the last couple of years. We actually heard it back in 2013. Then the HEC did some work on it and so forth and came back with mixed reviews, basically said, well, if you could find the money, perhaps you could consider it. But I guess I would characterize it as fairly lukewarm. Directive from the HEC regarding it. But I would say nationally, you know, it's been quite a bit written about this. We had actually in our higher ed committee this morning, Sarah Goldwick-Robb was Skyping in on a different issue, but she's someone from University of Wisconsin who's looked at a lot of these issues extensively. And, you know, the consensus, I think, coming back is that, yeah, it seems like an intriguing idea, but it doesn't do anything to fight costs, okay? It doesn't do anything to really cut, you know, which is, as you talk about increases in debt and so forth, we all, I think, acknowledge that the costs are going through the roof, but what are those cost drivers? And this doesn't help us. It wouldn't help the universities to rein in or be able to modify or be encouraged to train some of the things that they're currently doing. But secondly, and I'm looking back at some of the testimony we got from one of the provosts at OSU who ran the numbers and said that for their students, for a typical student, it actually cost them more money long run to pay this back. As you talk about percentages of income and so forth versus what paying off a typical OSU student loan would be. So again, I think as you get in and really lift up the hood and start looking at the concept and get beyond the free label on the front side, there's a lot of things here that just don't look as attractive as they might. And that doesn't even get into the point of what kind of a longitudinal data system do we have in the state of Oregon to really track something like this anywhere where a pilot could provide us with good data that could help us understand. You're talking about multiple years of a pilot program to be able to return anything that's going to be usable for us. But then we get into, enforcement, compliance, and who will be that? Is it going to be through LOR? Is it going to be through the IRS? I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, are we going to be in the business of tracking down deadbeat grads? Is that going to become our new norm here in the state of Oregon? So there's a lot of questions, I think, that need to be answered, but I certainly appreciate you guys bringing it forward. And
thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you very much.
Representative Johnson, great comments. That's why I think it's important to wrestle with each one of those. On affordability, I don't think any financial aid program is going to answer the question on affordability. I think the data in your committee, I'm sure, has gone through this in detail. The cost of administration has increased so much on the university system. At least I think that was the most recent report that was out. So, I don't think any financial aid program is going to address that issue in and of by itself. In regard to whether an OSU graduate would benefit from this program, again, I think that's why you have to make it voluntary. You have to make people understand and pencil it out for them. Say, if you make this choice, you will pay more over the long run. Is this more attractive to you for any reason? And which is why I think the idealistic part of it, and maybe I'm naive about that, knowing that when I was 18 years old, I think that would have been attractive to me to think that I'm doing something to make a contribution to a multi-generational contribution. So I think, again, the voluntary aspect of that is very important for it. And in terms of tracking down, we currently do, all our institutions track down students who are in arrears. As to where this would put a major weight on them to increase their efforts to have to track down students who are in arrears is a very legitimate question and needs to be worked through. So I appreciate your comments.
What he said.
Yep. Thank you. Other comments. We have several other panels, and I think some of the questions are appropriately addressed to them. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for your testimony today, and for those who brought the bill. I'm going to go down the list, and the panels have already been decided for me, so it makes it simple. Bob Brew and Carly Edwards, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Vega-Peterson, Vice Chair Bentz, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Brew, and I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, more commonly known as OSAC. OSAC's mission is to help students plan and pay for college. As the Student Financial Aid arm of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, we administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant, as well as many other state and federal grants. We also provide administrative assistance to the Oregon Community Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, and many other private donors in distributing their private scholarship money. Altogether, we dispense more than $75 million per year to Oregon students. The Pay It Forward proposal describes a program that would allow students to attend a public college or university for a period of time. During the initial period of the program, the tuition and fees would be paid by the state of Oregon. Once they graduated or otherwise left school, they would have a grace period, after which they would begin contributing a fixed percentage of their monthly income back to the program. If the program is successful, the hope is that the money returned to the program by this earliest group of students would be recycled and used to pay the tuition and fees of a future group of students until the program became self-sustaining. Under House Bill 2662, OSAC will ultimately be responsible for administering any pay-it-forward pilot or program that's adopted. During the 2013 legislative session, the legislature passed House Bill 3472, which directed the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to consider the creation of a pay-it-forward pilot. A work group was appointed and met from January through August of 2014. I provided staff support to that work group, as did my colleagues Susan Deegan from OSAC and Donna Llewellyn from the HEC. The work group was chaired by HEC Commissioner Rob Fulmer. A final 36-page report was presented to and adopted by the HEC on September 11, 2014. Subsequently, a letter to the legislature was prepared by HEC Chair Tim Nisbet and Executive Director Ben Cannon on behalf of the commission. In that letter, they expressed support for further development of the Pay It Forward concept, calling out three specific advantages to the program. The income-based payment model was more user-friendly to reach recent graduates. The program could be, over the long term, self-sustaining. And Pay It Forward eases the financial burden on middle-income students who are potentially ineligible for most need-based financial aid. They recommend creation of a program with the following caveats. Funds to support the pilot should not come at the expense of continued support for need-based aid. The state should design a funding structure that recovers the cost of the program from the participants, and before beginning the pilot, the state should carefully consider the costs and benefits of such a program to those available through any federally sponsored income-based repayment loan program existing at the time. While the final report I mentioned gives specific recommendations about how a pilot program could be administered, House Bill 2662, the bill you're considering today, is less prescriptive and gives the HEC some latitude to design the specific parameters of the pilot through administrative rule. As an agency director, I appreciate the flexibility offered in the bill at this stage of development. What you may not know about my agency, OSAC, is that for the 38 years between 1967 and 2005, we were the administrator for Oregon students participating in the Guaranteed Student Loan, which was later renamed the Family Federal Education Loan Program. At our high point, we had nearly 100 employees monitoring and servicing these loans. While the Federal Direct Loan Program, which replaced the FFVLP, is now run by the federal government, OSAC still maintains a small portfolio of other programs established by prior legislatures, including the Nursing Faculty Loan, the Paul Douglas Teacher Scholarship, the Medical Dental Loan Program, the Oregon Teacher Corps Program, the Oregon Nursing Loan Program, and the Nursing Services Program. These programs were either straight loan programs or scholarships that converted to payable loans when the recipients didn't meet the service expectations they agreed to. While the Pay It Forward proposal is decidedly not a loan program, these other programs are instructive because they were funded for a biennium or two, some as long as 20 years ago, but they're still active under OSAC management. Any proposed Pay It Forward program or pilot would have a lifespan at least that long. To restate the old cliche, when it comes to a new program as potentially revolutionary as Pay It Forward, the devil will be in the details, and the same will be true of any pilot. We have made an attempt to forecast the costs associated with developing a pilot, and some are fairly well known. For instance, we know that we will need some type of computer software, whether we are monitoring 500 or 50,000 accounts. The variable costs will depend on the parameters of the program, and some of the questions we will attempt to answer as the program is developed include, will students be able to drop in and out of participation term by term? Will students be able to attend any public college or university, or will participation be limited to a subset of schools? How will participants be selected, and how can we assure selection is fair and equitable while ensuring financial sustainability of the program? How will we treat the income of students that get married and file taxes jointly, particularly if the Pay It Forward participant is not a significant wage earner? Will students in educational programs or schools that have significantly different tuition and fees be treated the same in the contribution or repayment phase? Will these obligations be eligible to be discharged through bankruptcy or death? How will we be able to efficiently collect from students who leave Oregon for other states or countries, particularly if we don't have any type of reciprocity agreement with them? Will collections be sufficient to fund the administration of the repayment program, even if the pilot does not evolve into a long-term program? And while they're not specifically related costs to administering the program, other questions that are worthy of further exploration before a pilot is undertaken include these. How will these obligations be treated by regulators vis-a-vis consumer protection law? How will these contracts be treated by creditors in the Internal Revenue Service? Will the programs withstand legal challenge? And if not, what becomes of the outstanding obligations? These are all complex questions with associated costs, both financial and administrative. Nobody wants to saddle students with long-term obligations they weren't adequately prepared to assume. Neither do we want the state to create a program that generates more cost than benefit, particularly through unintended consequences. I believe the process for developing a sound pay-it-forward program through statute and rulemaking, while potentially worthwhile, will be long and complex. I would like to acknowledge that the advocates and supporters of this legislation have been very collaborative and cooperative in discussing these issues and sincere in their attempts to address them. I'd like to also add that many of the issues that I raised before, potential problems, could be addressed if this was reframed as more of a conventional loan program with either a fixed term or a fixed dollar amount payoff. Mm. Anyway, thank you for your attention. I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Please go ahead, and we'll have questions for the both of you at the same time.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carly Edwards, State Director of the Oregon Working Families Party. Since this idea was proposed in 2012, the Oregon Working Families Party has heard from thousands of students and their families that are desperate for a solution to student debt. It is also clear that the issue of student debt has potential long-term implications for our state's economy and our revenue base. At the end of the day, Oregonians need solutions now, and we see Pay It Forward as one more tool for our toolbox. Currently, our state is falling far short of the funding for higher education that we would need to make education affordable for working and middle-class families. Even if we were to achieve pre-recession levels, we would still be far below where we were a generation ago. I recently heard Chair Nesbitt of the HEC say that Oregon spends around $400 per student on financial aid, while states like Georgia and South Carolina spend four times that much. We need to expand existing aid, but we also need to do more. Unlike other financial aid models, Pay It Forward would create a direct return on investment for the state. Rather than seeing tens of millions of dollars of student debt payments leave the state each year, the Pay It Forward Implementation Fund would help secure not only the economic future of our current students, but would be available for future generations of Oregon students as well. Oregon Working Families is committed to continuing to fine-tune this pilot, and we believe that one of the best ways we can do this is to work closely with the HEC and OSAC during the implementation phase once this bill passes. To date, many of the questions that have previously been presented have been addressed in the HEC report, which is available on OLIS, or are capable of being answered by consulting with many of the same experts who were available during the work group process. We were confident that given the immense brain power surrounding the Pay It Forward pilot, we will achieve the high-quality program Oregon students deserve. Working Families is deeply appreciative to the work of the HEC, and we also highly value the expertise and role of OSAC in this process. It is our intention to help ensure that student applicants fully understand their obligation, rights, and responsibilities under this program. We appreciate the meticulous work that the HEC work group and OSAC has already put into vetting this proposal, and we look forward to continuing that work so that Oregon's Pay It Forward proposal can be a model for the nation.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? And I'll note that there is substantial material in OLIS from both of these people, so you may want to review that too. I think this may be the appropriate panel for me to raise some of the questions that I've been researching. I recently reviewed an article. I'm going to give you a citation for it. I don't think it's in OLIS yet. American Association of State Colleges and Universities, Policy Matters, July 2014, by Thomas Harnish. It's called the Pay It Forward College Financing Concept, a Pathway to the Privatization of Public Higher Education. Now, obviously, the author here has his own ideas about where this goes, but there are, inside the article, there were on page 3, there were several issues raised that I think are worth looking at and have only been tangentially talked about yet. One of them is the idea that I think Mr. Brewer talked about a little bit is this idea of what do you do with a student who comes into this program, participates in the program, and then drops out, doesn't complete the requirements, I think is the way you referred to it. And, of course, one of the possibilities is exactly what you suggested happens in other programs, that it converts to a loan with a regular interest. Has there been any discussion about how to handle that situation or similar ones where a student takes 6 years to complete a four-year program? Those kinds of things?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. That's a very interesting question. The challenge is that many of those the rules have not been written yet on that. So, for instance, if a student drops out or whatnot, they would still be, my understanding is they would still be obligated to contribute a percentage of their income going forward, whatever they agreed to. But obviously, if they don't complete a degree, that percentage will be much less in terms of dollar amounts than if they'd gone ahead and got their degree. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
Well, not really, because in a sense, then that student has failed to meet the student's obligation to the program, which of course is to finish a degree, eventually get work that is remunerative, and make a payment based on that more remunerative work, and dropping out or otherwise not completing leads to, as you point out, this lower payment. It would make sense, it seems to me, that if a person chooses not to comply with the agreement they originally made, that it would be reasonable to convert the contract to a loan with interest. That also would have the salutary effect of encouraging students to actually complete once they started.
Yes,
and that's an argument rather than a question, but that's what prompts my asking.
If I could interject as well, I guess I would also call this, though, what happens if someone gets hit by a bus, which I know that Michael Salvaggio has spent time thinking about that perverse scenario, but I believe that when they give their presentation, there's going to be answers for some of those specific scenarios as well.
That would be very useful. A second one that was raised in the article that I referred to was the graduate degree value issue. If this is to apply only to an undergraduate degree, what happens with somebody who decides after the fact to go on and get an MBA or an MD or some other advanced degree that results in probably significantly higher lifetime income and probably significantly higher first 20 years income? Based on the contract that we're discussing, I think they would be expected to pay an additional amount, even though you're not, even though this program would not necessarily be subsidizing their graduate studies. Thoughts about that issue?
Chair Barnhart, thank you. I believe the program, to a certain extent, counts on that. I mean, if you have somebody that gets a degree and gets minimum wage for 20 years, there's no way that a percentage of their income would necessarily cover their cost of their program. So in order for the books to balance, there has to be some contributors that actually contribute more than the cost of their education to make the books balance.
So if I understood you correctly, you're saying that advanced degree might be participated in by this program as well. Did I understand that correctly?
I'm sorry, if Chair Barnhart, if you understood me as saying that the program would help fund an advanced degree, I don't believe that's been contemplated.
Okay. All right. So, that's an issue in any event. Now, this voluntary participation idea, that's a conundrum for the insurance business. ACA, which we all know something about now as a result of the big changes that took place at the federal level and which Oregon participates in, dealt with that issue by essentially requiring everyone to either participate in a health insurance plan or pay a fine for failing to do so. The reason for that, of course, was the adverse selection issue, which would be that the time for me to buy health insurance is when I get sick, obviously, and not to bother with it other times. when, of course, that bankrupts the system very quickly to do that. If I'm if I'm a student who wants to go into the arts, and I think my income is going to be fairly low, or I plan to go into teaching where my income is going to be fairly low, this would be a great program for me because my repayment amount will be fairly low. If I'm going to go into engineering, computer science, medicine, or a variety of other programs where incomes are fairly high, my best bet would be to borrow money and pay it off that way rather than participate in this program. I have a very difficult time understanding how this program can pay for itself with that kind of adverse selection issue. Can you discuss that a bit more? How do you do this without making it mandatory for people who borrow money or otherwise would need to borrow money?
I think there'll be more also in the previous or in the following presentations as well. But I would say that also that this is part of why the pilot program is so important. I've also heard folks talk about how we've done a lot of work on paper, and now it's time to test this out to see if this is going to work or not. And I think that that's the importance of having the real-life application of the pilot program to see what effects there may be. But I know there has been more detailed modeling and other work that we can present to you on some of these issues.
Thank you. That would be very helpful. And then finally, my last question has to do with what would be covered. What would the program pay for? Would it be only tuition and fees? Would it include living costs, or what have you? What's the thought at this point?
Chair Barnhart, my understanding is, as it's currently written, tuition and fees alone.
Okay. So even though the major cost for many students are those other costs other than tuition and fees. Other questions that this inspires, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the question again that I asked the previous panel was, is it a deduction or is it after tax dollars that the student pays?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, thank you. The as you probably know, on your federal income tax, the interest that you pay on your student loan may be deductible depending on your income level. Since this is a contract, there's no interest associated with it, then there would be no interest to deduct. In terms of state taxes, currently there would be no deduction associated with it, but I believe you have some power to change that if you chose to.
Thank you. To build on the chair's questions, if you're a high-paid individual, let's say a doctor, and you took advantage of this program, your tax rates would be that much higher. Thus, the 3 or 4% that you are mandated to pay back, you would have to pay taxes on first at a much higher rate, perhaps than someone who was making less. So, has that been factored into these pilot project analyses? Because it would seem to me, if you're in the higher tax bracket, this would be something you wouldn't be enthusiastic about.
So, Representative Barnhart, Representative Benz, thank you.
Loans and interest are not deductible.
That's not been specifically factored in.
Thank you.
Could you find out?
Yes.
There was another hand down here. I'm not sure where. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. And just to build on the chair's questioning earlier, Bob. Tuition and fees, I think the formula is 40%-ish, approximately, of a cost of a degree. Is that what OSAC uses kind of generally to round off?
Maybe 30,
okay. So to your point, Mr. Chair, that this would only apply, well, to less than half of the cost. But I guess the question for you, Bob, would be that is there anything to preclude students from both utilizing Pay It Forward, but also perhaps accessing other loan sources, i.e. federal loans as well, to the point that they might have a payoff to Pay It Forward? They could also have fixed loan payments for other support that they might have, which obviously would contribute to a pretty fair debt for someone.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, thank you. So your question is, could somebody essentially max out their loans and participate and Pay It Forward? The total amount of financial aid that's available to students is based on the entire cost of attendance for that particular school, and these are published by the schools. So someone could conceivably participate and Pay It Forward and then borrow the maximum up to that cap, even if their expenses don't necessarily you know, justify that. They may be borrowing the maximum even though they're living at home and so on. So,
thank you.
Other questions for this panel?
I'm sorry, follow up.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
But they could do that now. They could max out their student loans now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And Barbara Dudley, Michael Salvaggio, Kelly Smith, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barbara Dudley. I'm a senior fellow at the Center for Public Service at Portland State University, and as the other Barbara over there, Representative Smith Warner, pointed out, I was one of the two professors who taught the senior capstone that resulted in this pay it forward proposal. The capstone was entitled, just for the record, Student Debt Economics Policy and Advocacy. And our students were mostly political science and econ students, and only two of them did not have significant student debt. Most were in their late 20s or older. Most had jobs, were living on their own, often with families of their own and children, were paying their own way through school. In other words, they were typical Portland State students. We asked them to look at the economics of student debt and try to come up with a realistic state solution. We focused on state solutions because although there were several promising federal initiatives at the time, such as the income-based repayment federal loan program, they were confusing to access. They were available only to a limited number of students, and they are utterly dependent on the vagaries of Congress and the next presidential election cycle. So in looking for state solutions, the capstone students looked at several options, and they zeroed in on the pay-forward model. The two features of this model that appealed to them, just for the record, are that it's a shared responsibility model with the state providing upfront funding for tuition and the student making a binding commitment to reasonable income-based payment after the completion of their education, which is when their earning potential is presumably higher. The other major benefit is that, and this is the one I think the Revenue Committee should be most interested in, that the payments a student make go into a state higher ed fund to pay for future students. It's estimated that approximately $200 million currently leaves the state per biennium in interest payments alone on student debt, on federal and private loans. Pay forward would keep that money in the state and make it available for the cost of higher education. As Representative Johnson pointed out, when this bill passed in 2013, sending this to a HEC work group, we were all somewhat caught by surprise by the effusive, glowing, overdone, hyperbolic national attention. And I think it's important to understand why that happened. It happened because on the same day, Congress had just raised interest rates on student debt to 6.8%, which most people found somewhat unconscionable, given what the federal borrowing costs were at the time. And it was nice to get the national recognition, but it totally threw off the understanding of what this was all about. And I think we need to zero back in, not on what the national media and then all the national academics who looked at what was in the national media said was our program. Our program is much narrower than what is described. The HEC work group, which was made up of economists and representatives from the HEC and OSAC and consumer advocates and students who had participated in the capstone, worked on this for months and months and took it to the HEC, as you know, and then it came back to you with the HEC's caveat that it's a worthy initiative, but it should not replace or supplement state support for higher ed students and institutions. We have no interest in having this become an excuse for the state to lower its contribution to higher education, nor for the lowering of support for the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
What you have in front of you now is a very broadly worded bill that does not mandate any particular details of the PIF pilot program. It builds on the work group's report and instructs the HEC and OSAC to establish the rules by which a pilot program would operate. And so when you ask specific questions of Bob Brew of OSAC how this is going to operate, I think what you need to say is we would like to come back, have you come back to us with the answers to those questions at a certain point in time so we see how it operates. And that is the point of a pilot program. You also want to see what the impact would be. It also, the bill also establishes the Pay It Forward Implementation Fund, into which would be deposited any funds the legislature chooses to appropriate, along with grants and bequests or private funds, and all the funds the students pay into the project. But this bill alone does not appropriate any funds. So all I want to do is urge you to keep in mind that this is a pilot program. It is in the design phase still. And we need to take seriously that we don't have other options that we are offering to students. This bill is not designed to control costs at universities, to answer Rep. Johnson's issue there. I think he's absolutely right, and that does need to be addressed. This bill doesn't do everything. It can't do everything. This bill addressed the crisis of student debt, and that's what we want you to take seriously, because there is no other proposal on the table for you to help do that, and our students and our state's economy are suffering as a result of that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio. Beside me is Kelly Smith from the Economic Opportunity Institute. She is here to answer questions. She's a policy analyst with them. She was a part of our work group process at the HEC level. Did I say my name for the record? Mike Salvaggio, here representing the Working Families Party and a member of the HEC work group. Mr. John Gibson, who had the most hand in the modeling, was unable to be here today due to a family emergency, so I am going to be speaking for him, and hopefully Ms. Smith can help me out. But if there's any detailed questions, I will be happy to forward those on to him. First, I'd like to go over the program outline very briefly. This is something that everyone knows already, I believe. Three steps here. First, the Pay It Forward program pays colleges directly for participants' tuition fees. Then the college provides that participant with an education. The reason I'm stopping here is because I want to say that this flow chart, as it is on the screen right now, represents a worst-case scenario for this program. Representative Bentz asked earlier where the liabilities lie, and the liabilities lie with this particular fund and therefore with the state. We have a lot of mechanisms that are designed to make sure that our cost recovery is as watertight as possible, and I will get into those as I go on. But like we said, students getting hit by buses, students moving to countries that don't recognize United States contract law, students otherwise unable to find jobs and make zero income as a result. This is the flowchart that you will see. It is strikingly similar to a lot of grant programs in existence currently. However, the PIF adds a step three to that, which is the participant repays the account portion of their earnings. Moving on to the bill very briefly, like was mentioned earlier, the bill is very, very simple. It's three pages. Sections 1 through 2 establish rulemaking authority regarding applications. I'm going to discuss that very briefly because, actually, I'm going to go to sections 3 or 4. Procedures and rulemaking authority for making and accepting payments. The question came up regarding how do we make sure that money is actually coming back into this program. And what we've built into the bill here is that OSAC is going to have the ability to work agreements and pre-authorizations into the application and participation process up front, so that later on when we are trying to collect from a student who has an obligation to this program, it will not be a case of try to find the student, try to convince them to let us see their AGI, et cetera. They will have signed those authorizations up front before they step into the program as a condition of being in the program. So in terms of how do we collect, it is much easier if we have an existing contract between the collector and the collectee. Section 5 establishes the implementation fund. It has broad receipts authority, as has been alluded to. Section 6 provides that the prior sections only take effect if there is sufficient money in the implementation fund to support a pilot program. Like I said, the bill is very broad, but we've done a lot of work on this already. The result of House Bill 3472 from 2013 was a HEC work group, and the HEC work group produced this document, which is available on OLIS. It was adopted unanimously by the HEC in September of 2014. It contains a lot of detailed answers to a lot of these questions. However, I want to stress that although this is the document from which I will be pulling my information in this presentation, the bill does not require that that OSAC hold specifically to this document, and they have a lot of authority to massage and adjust as they see fit. So this does describe the pilot, however. It asserts that there's voluntary and variable participation, meaning that if I'm a pay-it-forward participant, it's not all or nothing. I don't have to finance all 4 years of my education through PIF. I can choose to finance only 1 year or 2 years or even one semester. It contains cost estimates for the program, and it describes participation and payment parameters. So I will be addressing some of these points as we move forward. If there's any lingering questions, those are usually answered on pages 8 or 24 of that report. As we went through the work group process, we developed, or I should say John Gibson developed, a very detailed model to help us with our financial projections. We called that the PIF Interactive Calculator, and Eco Northwest was able to review that and bring their opinion to bear. I attempted to upload have the staff upload the interactive calculator to OLIS. I guess OLIS does not accept Excel spreadsheets. There's a PDF version, but I have emailed the Excel spreadsheet to all of your offices, and if anyone has a good idea of making that freely available, I'm very much open to that. Eco Northwest reviewed the calculator, said that they found the model to be mathematically accurate. We also found the structure of the model to be reasonable and useful. I want to note, though, that Eco Northwest did raise several concerns and suggestions, and I will summarize those very briefly here. That's gone more in depth into the Eco Northwest report and Mr. Gibson's response to that, which are both available on OLIS. Firstly, they suggested that we improve the characterization of adverse selection and other various variables. We went over that in a very detailed way. The consensus of the work group after those suggestions were reviewed is that we are at the point where we require more, I think what Mr. Gibson said was empirical information that would be needed to make the expansion realistic rather than hypothetical may not be available at this point, meaning that we need to see a pilot program to get more detail than we have already gotten. However, I want to point out that in terms of adverse selection, the work group determined that there's a high degree of uncertainty in the minds of many pre-college students as to what they're going to be doing, not only in college, but especially after college. There's going to be a lot of students that know that they're going to be an engineer and become engineers, and for them it's a set answer. Myself, I majored in political science because I found out that if I majored in political science, I could take Fridays off. So you just simply never know. The second point on that is just as students and their families choose loans over direct cash payments because it better aligns their costs with their ability to pay, there's going to be a lot of students that see a value in going with the PIF payment process because there's an economic value in mitigating their risk. And I'll get into that a little bit later. The Eco Northwest suggested that certain variables are honed a little bit. I'm not going to get too detailed in that because I suspect I'm already taking a lot of time. I will say that we made some changes in accordance with that, and those have been incorporated into the calculator. There were some discretionary assumptions that were asked to be adjusted, income growth and tuition growth primarily. Those were reviewed. It was found to have no substantive effect on the program within the parameters that were discussed. However, I will point out that if both tuition growth and income growth increase as was suggested, that would essentially kind of negate each other. But in terms of changes to the calculator, it was not, it was a de minimis need to change anything. The in terms of additional options for students, so getting into why pay it forward makes sense. Say you have three students, and the first one is going to do kind of well, the second one's going to do really well, the third one's not going to get off to a great start financially. If they finance by traditional loans, what they're going to see is they each owe the same amount. And this is pretty self-explanatory, but it's going to dovetail very nicely to my next slide. The pay it forward students are each going to pay a little bit of a different amount based on their financial ability. Now, the first group, you'll see that this provides a lot of certainty for the loan company. No matter how the students are doing economically, the loan company is getting paid the same amount. However, it doesn't provide a lot of certainty for the student. That student on the right there who's not doing too well still has to pay the same amount as his compatriot who's doing very well, and that's going to eat into his bills and his mortgage, or more likely rent at this point. The pay it forward students are going to have a lot more certainty with regard to their ability to repay. And this is what gets me into that economic value statement. There's an economic value to mitigating that risk. And even though the state of Oregon may not have all the money that it likes to throw into higher ed funding or student aid, what we do have a lot of in this state is pooling ability, meaning we can mitigate and spread out risk like nobody's business because we're very large. And we know that there's an economic value to that. And the reason we know that is because everyone here, I think, has investments, either personally or through their retirement fund, in fixed income assets. Meaning, if you have an investment that has a low assurance of ability to repay and a low expected return, no one's going to touch that because it's a lemon, as on my chart. If you find one on the high end of both axes, please let me know. I would like to invest in that. I don't believe in it. But most investments lie somewhere in the middle there. Equity investments have a low ability to repay but a very high return, relatively speaking. Fixed income investments on the other side of that. So we know in an economic sense that there is a value in mitigating that risk, and that's why students are going to recognize that there's a value in mitigating their risk. So in terms of the flexibility to students, I'll give you a couple of neat examples here. We've got student one decides to go to community college for first 2 years. His family can take care of 1 year of that. He's using pay it forward for the next year, and then he's going to transfer to university on pay it forward. The community college year is 0.75% of his income added to whatever other PIF financing he uses. Each university year is 1%. At the end of his college career, his PIF obligation is going to be 2.75% a year. Student two just wants to get an associate's degree at community college through PIF completely. That's going to be 1.5% or 0.75% per year at community college. Student three wants a four-year degree. He wants to be at a university all 4 years. He's going to use pay it forward for the entire career there, and that's going to be 4% per year. So you can see that this is not an all or nothing thing. Students who participate are not either 0% or 4%. This is flexible. And the most important thing I want you to take away from this is that whatever students don't pay with pay it forward, they are obligated to pay in another way. That could be loans. That could be their own family contribution. That could be a 529 account. But the reason that that's important is because at no point is the air taken out of the higher ed funding balloon or the necessity to mitigate those costs to students, because there is still an incentive, a very real incentive financially, for students to not only go and get as many scholarships and other financing tools as they can, but also for this state to help keep those costs under control, because those are still a financial pressure on students. I also want to talk about payout a little bit, because it was brought up that The Oregon State University had suggested that this was more expensive or commensurately expensive to some students. So a traditional loan versus pay-it-forward student, the OSU model that was submitted in March, they said $24,591 was the average loan amount. And they said that you could pay that off at 4.66% over 10 years. The total payout is $30,500 or thereabouts. Likewise, they compared that to a pay-it-forward student who would have been taking 180 credits of 4% of their income for 20 years. I'm assuming that student is at OSU for 4 years. And one of the salary examples was $38,000. There were several salary examples given. The total payout there would be $30,400. That's pretty close in. This is still all from the OSU testimony. But they said, well, if that student's making more than $38,000, suddenly they're ending up paying more than the loan. However, I want to point this out. That student that's taking out the traditional loans has a personal contribution of about a third, because four-year tuition at OSU and fees is $36,492. That loan is only 67% of that cost. So somewhere this student has a personal contribution of about $12,000. If you apply that same personal contribution to the PIF student, they only need to use PIF for 120 credits. So if you go into that HEC report on OLIS, you'll see that those 120 credits only clock out at 2.66% of that student's income, not 4%. That means that the actual payout is $20,216. Now, we can do that another way and compare the payout if they're entirely financing either through loans or entirely financing through pay it forward. So we see the dark blue bar is the pay it forward payout with net present value. The lighter blue bar is a income-based repayment plan or some kind of private loan. And we see that once you get to 140% of mean income, it does pencil out to have a loan. But it's important to note that there's a lot of students there that even though they feel like they may be an engineering student, might not want to take that bet that they're going to end up making more than 140% of mean income. So I can tell you that I personally would have said, you know what, I hope that I'm making more than that, but I'm not willing to take that risk. And students have the option here of saying, I'm going to go all in with pay it forward because I'm very risk averse, and that's the most safe bet I can make. Some students might say, I'm going to split the difference. I'm going to do half on loan and half on pay it forward. There's a lot of options for students here under this plan. We'll talk a little bit about data collection, and I will be wrapping up after the last few slides here. This is going to be the most comprehensive data that you've ever gotten in a pilot program, and I'm very excited about this because the really neat thing here is that when I come back to you, if this program gets set up and get you the data that Representative Smith Warner mentioned, I'm not just going to be bringing you data regarding how the PIF cohort is doing, because in that applicant pool, we're going to be tracking both participants and non-participants, which means when we come back to give you that data, it's not just going to be here's how the participants are doing. It's going to be here's how the participants are doing, here's how the non-participants are doing who applied to the program. But most importantly, here is the difference between those two groups. Here's the additive value that this program is bringing to this cohort of students. And I don't think that you're getting that with any other program that you are financing. So let's talk about financing. There are several different ways of doing this in terms of how to calculate costs. Those are gone over in the HEC report. It's extremely flexible. We can do this by saying we want the most accurate data available. We're going to put 1,000 students per year into this. We can also say we're going to put 2 students a year into this, and the data would be absolutely meaningless. I think there's going to be a happy medium somewhere. We wouldn't suggest doing it with less than 400 students, but there's nowhere that says that the state has to keep on putting the same amount of students in year after year. If this legislature decides that what it's comfortable with is starting with 500 students and then adding a cohort of 100 students the next year and then holding tight until we get data back, that's perfectly acceptable. I would hope that we put as many students as is humanly possible through the program, because that's going to be the best data that we can bring you. But nowhere here is there an obligation to the legislature to continue or increase funding beyond what we first initially financed. So that's my presentation. And as I mentioned, Ms. Smith is here to help answer questions. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I have one which is related to your initial financing slide, I think.
Shall I go back to it?
Sure, why not? The bill refers to sufficient funds. You only drop the hammer if there's sufficient funds in the account. What is that number? How do you figure that out?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe we would work with, I say we, but at that point it is a state agency question. But my understanding is that OSAC would likely work with the HEC, with various stakeholders, to ascertain what would be a statistically useful cohort to put through this program. I think if there was enough money to put two or five students into the program, I think there would be a consensus that that was not significant enough to provide useful information. I am not a statistician, but I would suggest that N equals 400 is a minimum.
I'm also not a statistician, and that's my guess, too. Did you have more you wanted to add to that?
No, I think Mike covered that.
Thank you. And the other thing that's not clear to me is how long you would, once you've made a commitment to a student, one assumes you're going to be committed to that student for a certain period of time. Can you give us a little more description of how that part of it works? Even if you decide to close the program, one assumes that you're committed to a student through the end of that student's education or 4 years or something. What's the thought about that?
Mr. Chair, the consensus seemed to be that, first of all, I'll point out that this slide assumes that any student coming in is going to see this program in existence and with them participating for 4 years at least. I would not suggest that the legislature obligate itself in a future biennium, nor I believe can it in this case. But I would suggest that the legislature had at least a conceptual understanding that for a student coming in year one, there would be a program in existence for them to participate in for at least 4 years, because what we don't want to see, our worst case scenario, is to make an investment in a student or have that student make an investment in themselves and then not come out of that with a degree, because then we are at our highest cost, lowest payout scenario. But I will point out this. Although we're asking the state to make a conceptual commitment to students, the student has a very hard commitment back to the state, because, like I said, we're going to be collecting a good portion of this assistance back from them. And even if the program rolls up, we will have this money coming back in. And we've had very detailed conversations with the Department of Revenue regarding the method and ease of collecting.
That prompts two other questions for me, and then I'll go to Representative Bentz or Representative Whitsitt. The first one is that in Section 5, page 3, line 12, you talk about gifts, devices, bequests. Is it anticipated there would be a significant amount of money contributed to the fund, or is this just a language that's in there in the hopes that there might be something?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I very much hope that we can see something like that. I can tell you that there's been a lot of national interest around this program. Oregon is further along than any other state, and my hope is that if we decide to move forward with this, Oregon can take some time, go out into some of these groups, some of these foundations, and say, here's an opportunity to prove this out once and for all, and not only prove out this program, but also, like I said, get that non-participating cohort compared with the participating cohort.
I think the answer is no plans at this time, but we've got it available in the law so that people can make the contribution if they want to.
That is precisely right, and it will have a much easier time doing that if this bill gets passed.
Yes.
If I might, Chair Barnhart, I have also had some preliminary conversations with representatives from the I Have a Dream Foundation, from the Oregon Community Foundation, and from the...
Yeah, if you move the mic a little further away from your... There, that would be better. Yes.
And from Meyer Memorial Trust about whether they would be interested in making contributions to this. And all of them were enthusiastic about the program, but wanted to see the state's commitment first. So I think that, you know, it's kind of a who goes first thing. I don't think you're going to get private foundations funding this without the state agreeing that they will administer it and put some of their own money into it.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's a shift of the risk here from the individual, but in a collective fashion from the individual to the state. I was just checking that the delinquency rate on student loans in general is around 9%, and I guess we could anticipate the same here. But because we are shifting that risk, there has to be an assumption on the state's part that it's going to have to support, put more money into this program than it's going to get out. That's my take on it. Is it correct to say that you guys have run the numbers on what that degree of risk is? Because in the normal course, as you all know, you make a loan to somebody and your interest rate, your term, all of that stuff is reflective of a measurement of the risk at the time of the loan. And in this particular instance, we are moving away from that and we're saying we've got a 4 or 3% for the rest of your life. And so all you really have to play with is the term, how long you're going to be locked into that. So what happens... The way I anticipate you would do this, it reminds me a little bit of the VMT, where the vehicle mileage tax, where we say in our pilot program, we'll let so many come in below the 21.5 cents, but we got to have so many above. Is that what you do? You say, we'll take so many art majors, but we also got to have so many MDs. otherwise, this is not a pan out. Mm-hmm. And since we know it won't pan out, we know already there's a 9% chance of losing. What are the numbers on how much money we're going to have to dump into this thing to make it work?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there seem to be two questions floating around in there, and I'll try to get at them one at a time. In terms of the delinquency rate, I bet those... collectors would have a much better collection rate if they had the statutory authority that our Department of Revenue has behind it and the ability to have some of those authorizations pre-signed before participation. For example, when a student pays their obligation, we're going to be able to compare that payment with their tax return. If that isn't matching up, if it's intentionally not matching up, we will be putting a deficiency on their tax return. If they're in another state, we will be putting a deficiency on that state's tax return or failing a tax return going to collections. But I want to say more fundamentally, the issue with student loans, as I see it, is that there's a set dollar amount that a person is obligated, no matter how much money they're making. So if I'm obligated to $300 in a particular month and my income is not matching that and I have to choose between paying my rent or my student loan, I'm ending up paying my my rent first. It's not that I don't want to pay my student loan, but if that obligation floats with my income, it's much easier to pay that. These aren't students who maliciously or trying to avoid paying their loans. These are students who are making very real prioritization decisions. With regards to the issue of there will be some students paying in more and some students paying in less, we have that flexibility built into this as well. If we come back to this committee in 2 years, 4 years, and say, holy smokes, every student who signed up for this and got into the program declared as a political science major like Mike, you've got a problem. I would suggest in that particular case that we need to start looking at some sideboards around what students are doing major-wise. I don't think that's going to be an issue. If you had a small group of students, two or five students, then you're absolutely at the whim of their selections. But if you have a large enough group, what we're seeing, based on our best available projections, is that we're going to see a very similar spread to what we're seeing now, and we've based our projections on that.
Thank you, Representative Whitsitt, please.
Mr. Chair,
very shortly.
Sure. If I could just add to that,
you'll state your name for the record.
Oh, Kelly Smith helpful. From the Economic Opportunity
Thank you
Institute.
Very much. Right.
If I could just add to that, the income series on which we base our contribution rates and have figured out how this pencils out, take into account average mean earnings from census data that encompass all majors. It encompasses under and unemployment, and so we think that it'll capture all of that variability that we can expect. We also use graduation rates that are available from OUS and the community college system to determine what percentage of these students may drop out and for which we can anticipate a lower income, which I hope addresses your question that you had earlier, Chair Barnhart. So as it is now, we have those things built into the calculator, and of course those can be adjusted as well as other factors.
Thank you. And is that information available?
That's included in the interactive calculator, and it's also in the HEC report, which are both available on OLIS.
Yes, and of course we've been looking at those. Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yes, you mentioned that this would be a contract and enforceable as such, and I was wondering how that differs from what we have now when you go take out a loan from someone. Isn't that a contract also? I mean, I'm trying to understand why you're differentiating this as one type of contract versus another type of contract.
Thank you for the question, Representative Whitsitt. It's not necessarily that it's a different type of contract. The difference is that a loan contract requires a principal to be repaid, whereas with Pay It Forward, the contract is to contribute a set amount of income for a certain number of years, regardless of any principal.
So I have a follow-up.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I was wondering if there is any legal thing here where they could come back and say, for example, if they're under the age of 21, I know contracts are age 18, but if they could come back and say, in a court of law, we did not understand due to our immaturity or whatever, that we were essentially indenturing ourself for the next 24 years, if that could be a legal, you know.
And while you're answering that, deal with the issue of discharge and bankruptcy.
Right.
And the other ways in which people can avoid the contracts that they have otherwise signed. Am I adding to
your
question?
Yeah, that was another. Is there any way that someone can get around this by bankruptcy, saying you've already received this? You know, is it discharged then if you declare bankruptcy into the future?
I can let Mike answer a little bit more for you on the bankruptcy question. But when it comes to the legal challenge, I'm not an expert in contract law. So we would have to wait and see. Our best guesses are that as long as it's an enforceable contract with somebody at the age of maturity, and that's 18 in Oregon, if I'm not mistaken, then we can expect it to be enforceable and enforced. With regard to bankruptcy, we know that student loans are very difficult to discharge in bankruptcy, and my hunch is that the same would be true of Pay It Forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Michael Salvaggio. This would not be dischargeable under bankruptcy. There's no set amount that the student owes. This would be an ongoing obligation that they sign up for, essentially. It would be akin to being able to discharge yourself from paying additional gas tax or income tax through bankruptcy. If a student is indeed bankrupt, if they're making no money in a particular year, then they owe no money in a particular year. There's no payoff amount. There's no bankruptcy clause. A student could theoretically move to a small desert island in the middle of the ocean, and we would wonder where they went, and they would have beat the system. But I'm guessing that we've worked a lot of that into our equations already, and this is as sound and as watertight as we can make it.
One follow-up, and it's something maybe the Department of Revenue could provide for me. In Oregon, the age of majority as to gifts is the age of 21 under Section 126.805, Section 1. And I was wondering what that would mean, since you're saying that they don't actually owe anything. Could someone declare this as a gift, since you're saying they don't owe a specific amount or something?
Why don't we refer that to staff?
Yeah.
And we'll have them look into that.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions?
Yeah. I also would, Barbara Dudley, Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, I just wanted to say that this is one of the things that Bob Brew from OSAC raised earlier as something that has to be looked at as they make their rules. And I want to just stress again that the parameters of 2662 are such that a lot of questions still need to be answered. Obviously, we would go to legislative counsel. We might even have to go to the attorney general to ask these questions and to tailor the program so that it works. Okay. So I want to keep that clear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today very much. Our last witness is Tim Cowan. Tim, want to come forward? And we do have one more item, which I don't think is going to take a huge amount of time, but if you can be succinct, that would be very helpful.
Chair and committee members, I'll do this real quick. I just have a couple comments, and I provided you the other ones in writing.
You did. Thank you.
Just to respond to a couple things that were just brought up, there is a basic assumption that the student knows what he wants to do when he goes to college. You have to be careful because colleges sell college degrees. Colleges convince college students to get master's degrees. And they promise them that when they get through with their degree, all the things they're going to get, all the positions, all the money that they're going to make. So in one response about would a student have any issues back to the college or the state or whatever, yeah, get me to pay for a college degree, and you're going to promise me that I can do something that I can't do. Now, to make it short, I'll go to the bill just real quick because I think that's a little bit more important. Line 15 through 18, how will you establish payments and what percentage of gross income? Line 22, what are the eligibility requirements? Is it based on anticipated gross income? The cost of the procurement of employment, starting wages, change in careers, change in lives, income sources, credit reports, net worth, other credit commitments. It could be something like a new family. Will you increase tuition beyond the cost of living? Will you take cost of living expenses into account? Because when they have to pay that back, cost of living is going to apply. Line 25, require applicants to agree to release information regarding, or the word you use.
Relating,
thank you. To income, educational attainment, and other demographic information, including anything that describes sources of income and uses, any expenses that did not. 22, method for calculation, the percentage of gross annual income during the payment period. My question is, Will other considerations be considered, such as health issues? Will you be accountable for HIPAA violations if that becomes part of it? That could be an intrusion in personal, family, work, or for an unlimited amount of time. Line 34. It says that the office may enter into agreements with the Federal Internal Revenue Service in order to verify income of the participant and the participant's household income. One of the things I thought I would share with you, I've always thought that tuition is nothing more than prepaid taxes. Wait until the IRS gets involved. Does gross income include a joint return? Is household income the same as individual residing with a taxpayer? That was brought up the other day. Since you have continued to reduce the state's portion of students' tuition, I have always maintained that the student loan is tax paid forward. And I think this IRS thing is going to have dramatic impact on people. Imagine when you pay your taxes, now you have additional taxes until you pay back the student loans. Put additional taxes on these kids for 20 years and see what they think about government.
Okay. Can you wrap up? That would be very
I helpful. Will.
Thank you.
That's it.
You asked, sir. You have raised a bunch of very useful questions, and I appreciate it. Are there questions for Mr. Collins? Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2662 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3344. Chris. Okay. And while he's getting ready, will Jeff Brissonette and John Patterson come forward, please? We'll hear from staff first and then from you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3344 modifies the RETSI, the Residential Energy Tax Credit, for solar water heating. For domestic water heating, the tax credit is the lesser of 50% of the device cost or $2 per kilowatt hour for the first year energy yield up to $6,000. And for swimming pool heating, the tax credit is the lesser of 50% of the device cost or 20 cents per kilowatt hour for the first year energy yield up to $2,500. Limits the tax credits claimed in any one tax year per taxpayer to $1,500 and allows a 5-year carry forward. The policy change would apply to certifications granted on or after September 1, 2015, beginning with tax year 2015, and it grants the department rulemaking authority to modify the incentive levels according to market conditions.
Great. Gentlemen, thank you for waiting through that long testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. We are here to talk today about solar hot water, something we've had conversations with many, if not most of you, about. Until relatively recently, about the last 10 years, Oregon was the site of a lot of solar hot water installations. It's a very efficient use of solar technology to save a lot of energy by preheating water before it's sent into a household's water tank, and basically makes the hot water tank work less hard. Over the last several years, the generation of electricity by solar systems, also called solar photovoltaic, has become more popular and in recent years has become the subject of higher incentives by tax credits. We're not here to say that that's inappropriate. It's very important. It's a very important part of the industry. But when you look at solar hot water and solar PV from a policy point of view, there's no reason to sort of treat them differently. A kilowatt hour is a kilowatt hour. And so we came up with a bill at the prompting of Mr. Patterson here next to me, who you'll hear about his experience, but with a very small increase in the residential energy tax credit for consumers, we could have a big impact on making sure that we kind of bring back the solar hot water industry. We protect the investment that we've made in about 25,000 installed units over the course of the year, and also take advantage of new authority that we gave to the Oregon Department of Energy a few sessions ago. Basically, previous to that time, tax credits were sort of set in statute and couldn't be changed except through an act of the legislature. And as efficient as the legislature is, still couldn't get kind of keep up with sort of changing dynamics out in the marketplace. And so the department has been very good and is getting better at adjusting the residential energy tax credit for solar PV, and we propose in this bill to give them the same authority to adjust the incentive for solar hot water, depending on market conditions. With that, I'm happy to answer questions at the appropriate time, but I turn it over to John Patterson for his experience as a solar installer.
Thank you. Mr. Patterson, give your name, please, and then your testimony for the record. Appreciate
it. Yes, Chair Barnhart and the committee, my name is John Patterson of Mr. Sun Solar in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3344, Amendment 5. Solar hot water heaters used to be a thriving industry in Oregon. Back in 1980, when I started Mr. Sun, it was the only solar technology in the state. By 2005, with backing from the Oregon Department of Energy, I invented a solar water heater called the Sol Reliant, which was designed for Oregon's climate. It never froze, worked on the hottest day of the year, the coldest day of the year, without any flaws, and would provide solar water heating for 30 years without any sort of maintenance. Although I eventually sold Mr. Sun Solar to Neil Kelly Company, I still own Sol Reliant and am eager to see this product developed and really take root. At its peak in 2008, the Sol Reliant system was the most popular system sold in Oregon. I had 10 full-time employees, and I was shipping systems to California, Pennsylvania, Alabama, Texas, other places. Mr. Sun was far from the only solar thermal company in the state. As of 2008, there were roughly 20 companies manufacturing and or installing solar water heaters statewide, including 5 in Portland, 3 in Bend, 3 in Eugene, 1 in Hood River and Pendleton, and at least 3 more downstate. All told, over 25,000 solar water heaters have been installed in Oregon since 1980. However, since solar electric systems emerged in the marketplace around 2005, there have been roughly 13,000 of those systems installed. Last summer, I was in the home of Jack and Adele Thompson, a North Portland couple who had received a bid for a solar water heating system 2 years prior, and they were now ready to go. They had heard that the cost of solar had come down, but then I informed them that the solar PV system costs had come down, but solar hot water had not. I explained that low-cost PV modules from China had driven down the price globally, but that nothing equivalent to that had happened with solar hot water. In fact, the price of copper had gone up dramatically in recent years, causing an increased price in solar hot water. They concluded maybe they should look at PV instead. I gave them a bid for a PV system that would deliver the same 2,500 kilowatt hours per year as the solar water heating system. It, in fact, would cost the exact same amount of money, $10,000. And that, by the way, remains true. Solar water heaters remain cost competitive with PV, delivering the same energy for the same cost. But in their case, after all incentives had been applied, the solar water heating system was a net cost of $5,000 compared to the net cost of PV for $2,500. Why is that, they ask, and I told them it was just the way the incentives work. It turned out that they did not have enough room for a PV system, that it would have taken 3.5 times the roof space to deliver the same energy. At that point, they threw up their hands and said, wait a minute, you're telling us that solar hot water is far more efficient and yet it costs twice as much, and it's just because of the way the incentives work in Oregon. There's something wrong with that, and I agreed, of course. The cost difference between solar water heating and solar PV is due only to the differing state incentives. It wasn't just hurting my business, it was killing the entire solar water heating industry statewide. The number of installs had gone steadily down since 2008. No new applications to the state solar hot water heater installation apprenticeship program, which I serve on that committee, have come in the last 2 years. Without trained technicians to maintain the 20,000 plus systems already installed, they are in danger of becoming orphaned systems without adequate technical support to sustain them. By equalizing the incentive for hot water and PV, we should see a gradual uptake in the number of solar thermal installations over time as the industry rebuilds. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. You've answered one of my questions, but let me ask the other one, and then I'll take from the panel. You've given us a hypothetical through your example. My recollection from seeing some of these systems is that a solar thermal hot water heater is about the same size in area, at least, as a solar panel for PV. Is that accurate or is
no? That's not correct.
Not accurate.
Not correct.
Okay.
The it's a lot easier to get heat out of the sun than it is to get electricity.
Yes.
Inherently, our most efficient solar thermal systems are about 80% efficient.
Let me ask the question the way I was going to ask it and see if you agree with this.
Okay.
Sounds to me that this system is a whole lot more efficient in terms of its uptake of energy mm-hmm. than a solar PV system is. How many panels of a solar PV system would you need in order to equal your hot water system, and how many panels worth would your solar hot water system take up in terms of area on the roof?
It's about 3.5 to 1.
Okay.
3.5 times PV. That's comparing the most efficient PV panels to the most efficient solar thermal panels.
Right. Thank you. So someone with a small area that they could put something on who use a reasonable amount of hot water would be better off from an energy uptake point of view using a solar thermal hot water system rather than a photovoltaic system.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's
Thank
correct.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt, please.
I was wondering, will the cost associated with this be as liens attached to the property?
Liens?
In my understanding, the credit that would come from this, will that come on the person's income tax, not or property tax, or...?
Income tax.
I think that's a question for staff.
Income tax
okay.
credit.
Yeah,
it's a state income tax credit.
Typically, all of these you pay for up front, and you get to take an amount off of the amount you owe for taxes on your income tax return, and that's the way you get paid back.
Right. So if you move, does it stay with the property then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what I'm after, really. So.
Oh, the device would stay on the property. You would still continue to get the credit because you've paid for it.
Well, unless you already used
it. Oh, okay. Right.
So the homeowner pays for it, they install it, then they get the credit.
Okay, so.
And then if they move.
It's carried forward for, I think there's a 5-year carry forward period, perhaps.
The carry forward pertains to, the credit can be up to $6,000 mm-hmm. for the one of them. But the most they can claim in any 1 year is $1,500.
Right.
So by structure, it's a 4-year tax credit.
Okay.
And then each of those years has a 5-year carry forward. And the carry forward pertains to the amount that somebody claims that they can't use.
Okay.
If you owe less than $1,500 in your Oregon income taxes, then you can't use the entire amount
right.
of the credit. You
okay.
can move it to next year.
Yeah, I was just after, does it stay with the property? Does it go with the person? It goes with the person. But the actual device stays with the property then?
Presumably it would stay with the property.
Okay.
The
One would not want to try to move one of those things, would you?
It's not cost effective to do that.
It is. Thank you. Other questions, Representative Johnson?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. We had some good testimony on this in our Energy and Environment Committee.
Yes.
And it was news to me as a builder that, you know, the solar hot water industry had really diminished in recent years because there really hasn't been any incentives for people to install these type of systems. Mm-hmm. But they are much more, they're easier to install from the installation standpoint. I think they give the homeowner, the property owner, much more flexibility in the locations. I don't think you have to have as full-on, as good of a sun exposure, I think, in certain applications to have these right. these systems to be effective. But if, in fact, you can consider in the design factor of a home how you might use this, there's a lot of ramifications for how you can use hot water, i.e., I mean, a lot of you are familiar with the thermal floor and heating systems and so forth. Well, if all you're doing is using the hot water to go into a storage tank or holding tank, well, you can circulate that in your floor to heat your floor with a very small little pump that just gradually, slowly rotates that hot water through a floor, and it's a very, very efficient way to heat a home. So lots of flexibility, lots of efficiencies, and I think it's long overdue that we extend this tax credit to this sort of solar efficiency measure.
Thank you.
I just have one question. Yeah. So would builders take this with them then? If they're, say, building houses for sale, spec houses, does the builder take the, because he's paid for it, the credit with him then?
I'd have to look into that. I'm not sure. But some of the credits have been structured so that the builder yeah, can basically transfer it or sell it to the homeowner. Yeah. But I don't know about this particular one.
The Red Sea?
All right. Well, I think it's worth pursuing to figure out a little bit better where these break-evens occur. It doesn't make sense to me, and I think it doesn't to you, Mr. Peterson, that we would have a different incentive for things that actually replace the same amount of otherwise external energy. And I think that's the point you're making, if I understand it correctly.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3344. Colleagues, House Bill 2150 is not ready, so we're going to carry over the work session on that. We may have an amendment by Wednesday. Let's carry it over till Wednesday in hopes that we actually have the amendment we need by then. The Department of Education and I have been having discussions about this issue. We want to get it fixed. And with that, thank you very much. With that, the committee is adjourned.